Buddhism has probably become most famous for something the Buddha never taught. I remember when I was in a monastery in Thailand, my grandfather wrote to me. "I know all about Buddhism," he wrote in a letter. "Life is suffering. Eightfold Noble Path, write this and write that." This is what he wrote. "Write this and write that. Come back to the safe fold of Christianity. One religion is more than enough." So this was 15 years ago. And just the week before I left, a few days before I left to come here, I got an email from my uncle. My grandfather has died a few years ago, but his son now wrote me another letter. Because I'd had a mail out about some seminars I'm doing about clinging in England with a psychotherapist there. And somehow my uncle had gotten onto the mailing list, so he'd received this information. And he wrote back, "I know all about Buddhism." Almost word for word, he said the same thing. He says, "Life is suffering." So often, when people who know all about Buddhism talk about it, they come up with this old chestnut: life is suffering. Ah, yes, that's our Buddhism, life is suffering. The Buddha never said, life is suffering. If the nature of life fundamentally was that it was suffering, that would be it, wouldn't it? There'd be no way out. There'd be certainly no point in us coming here. If that was the essential, absolute way things are, life is suffering, there'd be no hope. What the Buddha did say, and he was very, very concerned with suffering, he said that in life there is suffering. He called this noble truth, so I'm sure you're familiar with the four noble truths. And the first noble truth, which he said is to be understood, is that there is suffering in life. And that it's really important that we acknowledge that. That we recognize that. That we really understand that that's kind of built in. Things not going the way we want them to is normal. Because what tends to happen is, when something goes wrong, when something happens that isn't the way I'd like it to happen, we tend to think that there's something really wrong with that. That it must be my fault. Or maybe it's your fault. Or it's just the kind of life's fault. God and the angels ganging up on me. And we forget that life like that. Sometimes it's very sweet and pleasant, and things happen just the way we'd like them to. And the other 90% of the time, it's not. And that sometimes, often even, things happen, despite our efforts to the contrary, things happen in a way that we wouldn't have chosen. And the Buddha asks us to recognize and acknowledge this truth, so that we don't get confused. We don't start casting around for whose fault it is and what we need to do about it, and create a whole bunch of extra stuff on top of the fact that something unpleasant happened. And then the Buddha says, what is suffering? And basically, having what you don't want, not having what you do want, being with what you don't want to be with, not being with what you do want to be with. It looks at all the ways in which unpleasant things happen to us. And then he says, points out very clearly that what makes for dukkha, for suffering, is clinging. And I mentioned this morning. Where there is suffering, there is clinging. Where there is clinging, there is suffering. So before going on with the talk, I'd just like to kind of define these terms a little bit. And does everybody understand when I use the word clinging? Does anyone not understand when I use the word clinging? Huh?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. So in English, to cling means to hold tightly to something. So clinging, grasping, being tight, contracted. It's that we can feel if we look carefully every time we're suffering. There's that, there's a pushing against, there's being in conflict with. So this word suffering has become the kind of standard translation for the Pali word dukkha. And there's no single word that really can do. Suffering's become the standard translation. Some people use other translations, unsatisfactoriness or stress. But really, dukkha means, covers the whole range from the kind of agony and real major trauma, distress and pain that human beings can feel, down to mild unease, awkwardness, feeling ill at ease, anxious. So from the very gross to the very, very subtle. And I think it's important to bear that in mind when we talk about dukkha, even though we might use the word suffering. Suffering is just it's a rather too narrow to capture the whole meaning of dukkha. So this statement is it's a very strong statement that the Buddha makes. Where there is suffering, there is clinging. That means there's no exceptions. Where there's this, there is this. And the other way around, where there's clinging, there is suffering. So it's really worth, I think, taking a good look at such a categorical statement. And looking at, because we're concerned with the human condition and the fact that in life there is suffering, and that that's the whole knot of the problem. We're not here to work out how to deal with our happiness. It's how to deal with that which is painful, that which is difficult in life, that brings us to this kind of inquiry. I'm always interested to hear people's stories of how they first came into contact with Dharma practice. And you know, the different kind of the different ways, different lifestyles and different events and different circumstances and all the different ways in which people have somehow found their way to practicing Dharma. I find it very interesting. Much more interesting than what people do for a living, for example. So, but what's common really, and you can look for yourself, what's really common means absolutely common to everybody, is the reason, what brings us to really want to look deeply at our lives is dukkha, is suffering. That sense that there's something difficult in my life, that, and the intuition that it shouldn't need to be like that, that there must be a way of being free of that, not bound by that. So this is the issue we're really primarily concerned with understanding in our lives. What is suffering? And what is freedom from it? So the Buddha says suffering, whether suffering is directly, clearly related to clinging, contraction, tightness. So I'd just like to look at some of the ways, some of the common ways that clinging shows itself, because wherever it shows itself, where there's clinging, there's suffering. And so if we're looking at our kind of human psychology, we could say, the way the mind works, it's not as an intellectual exercise. It's not to understand Buddhism. Really not interested in the ism. The problem with Buddhism often is not enough Bud and too much ism. Buddha means awake. So people are heard to say, oh, so you're a Buddhist. So, but often they're, all they're seeing is the ist. And then no, not really interested. But if what they mean by Buddhism is awakeism, yes, I can, that sounds all right. I keep going off on these little tangents, but it's okay. So to look at the ways clinging shows itself, and one of the main areas, one of the places that we get caught so easily again and again, where we get tight, where we get contracted, where we cling on, is in the whole realm of wanting, desire, lust. It's kind of classical words that we often feel a bit kind of uncomfortable using. So, wanting. So much of our life is driven by what I want. And it's really, really interesting to look at. Not because, and again, just like the Buddha says there's suffering in life, and somehow we get, that gets distorted into life is suffering. When we start to talk about wanting in Dharma, very easily people seem to get the idea that the view is being given out that there's something wrong with wanting, that wanting's a terrible thing, that and that the Buddhist goal is kind of the end of all wanting. So, just to try and clarify, when I talk about wanting, I'm not. That's not the view I'm trying to give out. There's something wrong with wanting, but I am trying to say we get into a lot of trouble in the movement of wanting. So we better really have a good look. What's going on in wanting? What's going on that's useful, if anything? And what's going on that's useless? What's going on that's actually getting me into trouble? The thing is with wanting, we always think that it's going to be it. That it's going to give us some peace or satisfaction. And so we chase after it. So the idea comes, we're out in the hot sun. I can hear a few laughters. You think of all the things you were wanting this afternoon. I wish I was... tonight, I'll have a shower. Oh, I would love a shower. Oh, it would be so great to have a shower. From a normal kind of thought, hot, sticky. The guy at the front's making us all sit in the hot sun with no shade for an hour. Of course you're going to want a shower. So there's the thought, hot and sweaty, oh, I want a shower. There's nothing wrong with the thought, I want a shower. But what happens very easily, it's just a thought passing through, related normally to the hot and sticky condition of the body. Body's hot and sticky, wouldn't it be nice to have a shower? Yes, it would. But what happens is, we start to get caught into that. Oh, I really want a shower. And we start to tighten around the thought, I want a shower. And therefore, we look at this poor, we look around in the desert. Where's the shower? Nowhere. And so we start to, the more we contract around that thought, the more we create this gap between where I am and where I want to be. In the shower, in this case. And of course, when you're out in the desert at midday, that gap can be very big. It's at least until 6:30. So we look across this gap of where I want to be in the shower. We forget that when we get home, maybe there's a queue. We forget that often the water isn't really that hot. we forget that, you know, whatever it is, that the shower really isn't the kind of holy mecca of the retreat. And we project the resolution of all our troubles and problems and in life to the shower. No? I mean, we wouldn't say this philosophically, but this, if we look carefully, this is how we're actually relating. I'm exaggerating, of course. I'm terrible at exaggerating, but that's the movement. We're hanging our happiness on the shower. And of course, I'm just using this one example, but it's in any aspect of life, in anything where wanting moves towards something and we tighten around it. I must have, I need, I want. And we make that very important. So then, the distance between where I am and where I want to be, that distance is an exact measure of our suffering in the moment. We suffer across that gap between where I am and where I want to be, or who I am and who I want to be, or what I've got and what I want to have. There in the moment, and the tighter that's held, the more clinging, the more suffering. And if it's just a thought, oh, it'd be nice to have a shower. Oh yeah, it would be nice to have a shower. Maybe I will when I get back. No problem. But when we start to think, oh yeah, and it's hours till I get to have a shower, and it's just going to get hotter, and then just, and the more we add on, the more tight, the more clinging, the more suffering. So that's one way in which the clinging around the wanting clearly produces anxiety, tension, dissatisfaction, misery, complaining, moaning to ourselves in the moment. Another way that we get into trouble with wanting is in the actual getting of the object of wanting. So what I mean by that is, finally we get home for the shower. Or to take another example, it might be the lunch. Very good example. So we're sitting here, and we know it's that sitting that leads to lunch. Not the sitting that leads to enlightenment, the sitting that leads to lunch. Lunch is way more important than enlightenment by about 11 o'clock. So we think, oh, it's difficult, it's boring, or the leg hurts, or whatever it is. Because of course, if we're feeling at ease, if we're connected, if we're grounded where we are, we're not going to suddenly start making a big fuss about lunch. But it's in the moments where wanting rears its head. So there's some unease in the moment. Some object springs into consciousness, lunch, either because we smell it wafting through the door, or just because the memory, or because we've opened the eyes and seen quarter to lunchtime. And we say, oh, lunch. And we, again, same thing, we hang our happiness on lunch. How many lunches have we had in our life? And how many of them really gave us decent, lasting, quality happiness? I've had some really good lunches, but none of them were that good. So we say, lunch. Oh, I can't wait to, you know, the bell to ring and have lunch. Eventually, some miracle, the bell rings. Lunchtime. We go to get our lunch. Just what we wanted. Cleaner. Oh, whatever it is. If you notice, the relief is already there. We thought the happiness was in the lunch, but the relief is there before we even get to eat the lunch. How can the happiness be an ingredient of the trina? How can the happiness be in the lunch when the relief is there before we even eat it? Do you see what I'm saying? We think the happiness is in the lunch because we say, oh, this is terrible, I just want lunch. And we start to dream of lunch as this wonderful thing. It doesn't have to be lunch, it can be anything. It can be sex, it can be traveling, being on a desert island, it can be chocolate, it can be, these are the gross desires I'm talking about, the simple ones. It can be lots of much more subtle things, which I'll maybe get to in a minute. But initially, something gross, something that I want, becomes this big deal for me. I get fixated on it, and I say, when I've got that, I'll be happy. Philosophically, I wouldn't say it. Nobody would claim that lunch is really, you know, the big, all-enlightening experience. But in the moment when we hang our happiness on something I want, that's actually what we're expecting from it. And what actually happens is when we get the object of our wanting, in this case lunch, we feel relief. Huh? Anything we want. So I want anything. I really want that new dress I saw in the shop, or I really want whatever it is. When we get it, we feel happy. Huh? We want something, we get it, we feel happy. So it's really worth seeing what's happening there. We tend to think that the object has given us the happiness. So I want lunch. I'm unhappy now, I'm agitated, I'm fed up, I want my lunch. Bell rings, in we go, there's lunch. Lovely, lunchtime. And then we think, but we mistakenly, because we're not looking clearly, we think the lunch has provided us with that sense of relief or ease or happiness. But the fact that the relief or ease or happiness came before we actually even ate the lunch, there's a clue in there somewhere. What's given us the feeling of ease or relief is the end of wanting. Of the heat and the drive that's going along with I want, I want, I want. And then we get, and then there's some relief, because wanting is fundamentally uncomfortable. Hot. Prickly, agitating, because wanting is a basic expression of this moment ain't good enough. That's why I want something else. If we're really contented in this moment, the definition of contentment is, or happiness or peace, is not wanting anything else, not needing to add anything to this. So the very movement of wanting is agitating. It's got to have something else, therefore this isn't good enough. When we get the thing, we say, and we think that the thing is what's responsible for us feeling peace or relief. But actually, the thing has just been the catalyst for our wanting to subside temporarily. Very temporarily. Because what do we notice? No sooner have we got one thing, we feel that, so we want lunch. We're waiting for lunch. The bell goes, we get the lunch. That ought to be enough. If the happiness was in the lunch, lunch would be enough. But no sooner have we taken one, two, maximum, three mouthfuls. Seconds, you understand? Seconds. Another more lunch, no? I wonder how much there'll be left when I finish this. So we start to eat faster. Because the wanting movement hasn't been understood, and so it goes on unchecked. Wanting just keeps sustaining itself. When we get one object, we just move on to another object. When we get the seconds of lunch, we're already thinking of the siesta afterwards. How long are we going to keep pursuing things, pursuing people, pursuing experiences? Pursuing, you understand? Trying to get, wanting. Under the bizarre idea that finally I'll have gotten enough things, people, etc., that wanting will what? Just subside on its own? It doesn't matter. You only have to read I don't know if you have them, maybe you're blessed in Israel, you don't have these kind of dreadful celebrity magazines. Well, you do, I'm sure you do. If you want to see the futility of wanting, you just have to open one of these magazines. People that are young, beautiful, ridiculously rich, incredibly powerful, thousands of people falling at their feet. They've got enormous wanting power. And they have got usually highly confused lives. They've got the power, they get to realize huge amounts of wants. And what kind of happiness does it seem to lead to? So wanting is a force going on through our lives every day, in a thousand times, many, many times. Any moment, in fact, that there's not complete ease of being and peace of mind and contentment, there's wanting. Therefore, we really ought to pay attention to the process of wanting, because it is driving our lives along. We're slaves to wanting. Wanting says, lunch, and we say, right, yes, and off we go. And we give up, we sacrifice, we give away all the possibilities that exist right here in the present, and we subjugate them, or we sacrifice them, for this dream of what I want. It's tragedy. So, Dharma teachings really encourage us to engage with the whole process of wanting, to get to know it, to see the process so well that we can see the beginning, see the movement, and see the end of wanting without needing to go running after the object itself. So we might be sitting in meditation and the thought comes, oh, I'm hungry, or oh, wouldn't lunch be nice? And we start to want lunch. If you notice that that's happening, it doesn't have to be about lunch, though it usually is on retreat, but it could be about anything. Just to see if you can follow it as the movement of wanting. Forget the lunch. Forget the object. Just to see, as soon as there's something arisen in consciousness as the object of desire or wanting, can we just disenchant ourselves from the object, whatever it's called, and actually engage with the process of feeling the wanting. When we let the process of the wanting unfold, according to its own energy and limit, it has its life and dies away. The relief from wanting doesn't need the object. So the Buddha says, wanting is one of the major areas in which we get tight, in which we cling. And where there's clinging, there's suffering. In all the ways I've just tried to kind of unpick from the movement of wanting. So another area the Buddha talks about is views and opinions. Again, kind of classical Buddhist language. Ideas about. And just as we're full of wanting, we're certainly full of ideas. Ideas about this, ideas about that, ideas about who I am, ideas about who you are, ideas about what life's like. Again, the Buddha's not saying there's anything wrong with having ideas, but he is saying when we cling to ideas as being the truth, we get into trouble. So just a very immediate example, the sense of who we are. All kinds of ideas about being fat or thin or clever or stupid or witty or shy or good looking or not good looking, male, female, our age, etc. A whole bunch of views about ourselves that we hold to be the truth of the matter, and therefore we make ourselves incredibly vulnerable to anyone that doesn't agree with our ideas, or to our own changing sense of that. So we say, oh, what do we say? No examples there. Okay. Well, I'm smart. So we say, I'm smart. I got exam results. I'm a clever guy. We build our identity, our sense of self, I'm smart. And we carry that around. I'm smart. Can you see how we're setting ourselves up for a fall? As soon as we have some idea, I'm this, what happens when the evidence contradicts us? When we clearly get it wrong? When we say something stupid, or when we, whatever, when somebody else is smarter than us? Unfortunately, there's always someone smarter than us. So we're setting ourselves up through clinging to our ideas. It's fine to have the idea, oh, I'm this age or this, but we believe that that's the whole truth of the thing. I'm smart. It's a difficult point to understand, but can we see how a momentary description, huh? Something happens, someone asks us a question, we give a good, clear, comprehensive answer. Good. And then the thought arises, oh, I'm pretty good at this, I'm pretty smart. It's okay. But what we do with the thought so quickly, so easily, if we don't see it, is we construct our identity, we make something fixed out of I'm smart, and then we have to defend being smart. A brief description of a moment becomes a fixed thing. Same for our ideas about anything else. Our ideas about time, for example. When we arrived back here today, Galit mentioned that sense of arriving, standing in the same place. Everyday mind says, well, we stood here this morning, then we went off and walked in circles in the desert. Then we came back and we stood here again. Big deal. But Galit says, that's everyday mind, but Galit says, what's the difference? What's changed? Everyday mind says, what are you talking about? But there's a way in which we're invited to the question, what's changed, or what's different, or what is this, invites us to challenge our views and opinions, our fixed ideas about how things are. We suffer over clinging to our ideas, in this case, about time. So it's the same as the example with the shower. I'm here, and I want the shower, and it's so far away, it's hours away. Just in one sitting, when we want the bell to ring, and the leg's hurting, we say, it's only 20 minutes into the sitting, and my leg's hurting. How am I going to manage for another 20 minutes, another 25 minutes? Or whose idea was that to have an hour-long sitting in the morning? Another 40 minutes? How am I going to manage? That becomes very difficult because we've clung to the idea, I have to be with this for 40 minutes. Of course that's too much to ask. Sounds terrible. But there's lots of assumptions in there. There's the wanting already, wanting this to go away. There's the fixed idea that this is going to stay exactly the same. How am I going to be with this for 40 minutes? This means this leg like this, pain. There's so many fixed ideas in there. And then there's the whole relationship to time for 40 minutes. 40 minutes does not exist. You don't have to be with anything ever for 40 minutes. Except these Dharma talks. We're invited, life's pleading with us, just to pay attention to this. We're invited to be with this. Just right now. If we can be with it for this moment, and then can we be with it in this moment? If I ask you to be with some difficult sensations in your leg, just for a moment. Just for a moment, that's all. Just to be with it for a moment. That's kind of doable, no? Even if it's very hot, just for a moment is doable. So please, just to notice what's going, just to be with the difficult, just for a moment. And then, just for a moment. And then, just for a moment. These are not a series of clever ideas. These are not a presentation of what the Buddha taught. This is an invitation for us to meet our life in a way that will be truly helpful, rather than meeting our life in a way that we come up against tightness, contraction, confusion, pain, dukkha. So the opportunity is there really to engage with the way we get tight around things, to look for clinging, and to just be willing to suspend our certainty that life's like this, that I'm like this, that that's what I want. As soon as we come up with any fixed thing that we want, that we think, to be willing to just introduce some doubt as to whether that's the whole truth. To see, as I said this morning, what am I holding on to that's making this painful? So that's some of the key areas that the Buddha talked about clinging. And at the heart of all of that, the third main area the Buddha gave attention to is clinging to self. And that really underlies and underpins any other area of clinging. And time is going on, and I've talked a lot about the other things, and so I wanted to talk about clinging to self as well, because it's the cherry on the cake. But maybe I'll leave it and we'll talk about it tomorrow, because Matt's getting on. So maybe I'll leave it there for tonight, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. No. I can't tell if you're relieved because you're tired or if you're disappointed because you're... Really nice. Very keen yogi. Very good. I can talk about clinging to self for hours. Huh? Ah, yes. Right. You hear it? Do you hear it? She says not for hours, just for a moment. So enough for tonight. Until tomorrow's Dharma talk, we can pay attention to clinging to wanting, clinging to views and ideas. And if we're clinging to those, at the bottom of it, has to be clinging to self.